This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. Speaking with me this morning, Bill Hayton, Associate Fellow with the Asia-Pacific Program at Chatham House and author of the book South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. Bill, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for the invitation.
So perhaps you could set the stage for us a little bit. When we talk about the South China Sea, what does the landscape look like currently?
Well, politically, it's sort of in a in-between phase. It's not as hot as it has been recently, but it's not as quiet as we'd like it to be. There have been reports of confrontations recently off the coast of Borneo, with involving Malaysian, Indonesian ships on one side and Chinese vessels on the other side. Late last year, we had confrontations between China and Chinese vessels and Vietnamese vessels to do with oil exploration. Right now, it seems to be quiet, but one never knows how long these things are going to last. It might be helpful to people if I say that there are two kinds of disputes in the South China Sea. There are disputes about the rocks and the reefs, the islands, and then there are disputes about the spaces in between the islands. So Indonesia isn't a claimant to any of the islands or rocks and reefs. So in that sense, it's not part of the territorial disputes, but it definitely has maritime disputes with China. It says that it doesn't. It says that there's no way that under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea that China can have any claims. But the point is that China is behaving in a way that puts itself or puts its ships into contention with Indonesia. And so I think this is why we're seeing a renewed use of language by Indonesia about international law. They're basically saying the Convention on the Law of the Sea gives us the rights to the fish and the oil and gas near the Natuna Islands, and they don't accept any Chinese justification for its own claims there.
So what basis do they have to say that they have historic rights over the waters of the South China Sea?
Well, I would say that the idea of historic rights is itself not very historic. And I've traced it only as far back as the late 1980s, early 1990s, when it started. This idea started to be used actually in Taiwan, and then it sort of spread across the Taiwan Straits into China during the later part of the 1990s. So before the very late 1980s, nobody ever used the words historic rights in connection with, say, catching fish or oil and gas in the South China Sea. It's a very modern invention. And I think most people, most international lawyers, certainly outside China, don't really give it much credence. So that's really the problem is it's very recent. But to try and sort of explain how supporters of the historic rights claim, China's historic rights claim, argue it, they would say that a line which was drawn on a map published in China in 1948-49 defines some rights to the waters. But my research has been to try and show that this line was drawn, you know, more by accident and mistake than conscious logic. And other people have shown that even when this line was drawn, it was never intended to make a claim to the resources of the waters. It was supposed to be a line indicating which islands or rocks and reefs China was claiming, nothing to do with the resources. And I think what I tried to do subsequently, even after the book came out, was do a bit more research on this. And my conclusion is that it really is a mistake. The whole thing just shows the marks of translation errors and bad map making. And the sad fact is that Malaysia, unfortunately, is one of the main sort of victims, I suppose, of this mistake, because China now claims a piece of seabed only about 100 kilometers off Borneo as the southernmost point of its territory. So that's a piece of seabed known in English as the James Shoal, in Malay, Beting Serupai. And it's 22 meters below sea level. So my question was to try to understand why China claims this underwater land as territory. And then my first clue was that the name that China gives to this is Zhengmu Ansha. And Zhengmu is simply the transliteration of James. And then from that clue, I began to unpick the rather confused history of the South China Sea. And really, it all boils down to one particular professor, a guy called Bai Meichu, who was active in the mid-1930s in trying to assert China's territorial claims, not just in the sea, but around its land borders. And he made a series of mistakes, which ended up with him publishing his own map of the South China Sea with a line around it. And he invented various islands in the South China Sea, all of which were actually underwater. And he drew them on his map as being islands. And then he drew the very first line around these three, which made the line very close to the coasts of the other countries. And it's clear from the fact that he drew these underwater features as islands that he really had no idea what he was actually doing. The problem was that this line was then adopted by the Chinese government after the Second World War to be a serious claim, when really it should have just been thrown in the waste paper basket.
Are you saying that basically all of the disputes and the issues arising from the South China Sea basically stem from a mistake by one man with the aspirations of being a cartographer?
Yes and no. I mean, he's the main figure in the story. And the link is that two of his students that he taught in the 1930s were then hired by the Republic of China Ministry of Information in the mid-1940s to advise the Chinese government on which islands it should claim after the Second World War. And it's worth saying at this point that China never made a claim. No Chinese government ever made a claim to any of the Spratly Islands, the ones closest to Borneo and Malaysia, until December 1946. So this is not an ancient claim. It's very, very recent. And as late as the 1930s, even possibly, as late as 1943, Chinese government documents and statements only claimed the Paracel Islands much further north. They made no claim to the Spratlys. It was only in 1946 that the claim comes down as far south as the Spratly Islands and then to James Shoal.
All right. So in some previous interviews as well, you've mentioned that China's claim to the South China Sea is built almost on a sense of righteousness. This is in contrast to the US, which regards the area as geographically strategic. So is there any way that you can see to reconcile these two very different perspectives when it comes to the South China Sea?
Well, I think, yes, part of the problem really for the region and the world is the emotional value that China and a lot of Chinese advocates of the claim have invested in the territory argument. This sort of sense that, you know, the Spratly Islands, even if they are, you know, the size of the desk you might be sitting at right now, you know, they're tiny, many of them, and some of them are, you know, barely above water at high tide, and that somehow these have become vital for restoring, you know, the pride of the country, just like, you know, recovering Hong Kong or Taiwan has become important, when really their actual material value is tiny and negligible. But, you know, there's an emotional part to the Chinese claim, which I think is can be difficult to deal with. But there's also clearly a strategic part, which is that China has built these seven very large bases down in the Spratly Islands, which give it all kinds of capabilities, whether they be having a harbour for naval ships or bases for radar and intelligence gathering and listening stations or anti-submarine warfare. There are kind of these bases are very useful. I think what the compromise way forward is that you have other countries that are claiming some of these islands, Vietnam, Malaysia, Brunei, the Philippines, and Taiwan, depending on whether you consider that to be part of China or not. And they all occupy different features. My own research leads me to the conclusion that for the most part, these are the only occupations that there have ever been. It's not like in the past, in ancient history, you know, any one of these countries occupied all of the features and they need to get them back. The occupations really only began, certainly in the Spratly Islands, after the Second World War in earnest. Only Britain and France as colonial powers had really made any efforts to occupy the islands before the Second World War. And so, therefore, there should be room for a compromise where basically everybody just keeps the features that they currently occupy and recognize that UNCLOS, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, basically, you know, sets the rules for what happens around those islands. And everybody then agrees that warships can sail through without interruption and that the different states have got the rights to the oil and the gas and the fish and so forth. And that, in theory, on paper, should be a neutral and, you know, internationally lawful way of resolving the disputes.
I'm speaking with Bill Hayton, Associate Fellow with the Asia-Pacific Programme at Chatham House and author of the book South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. After this, we'll be talking about measures to resolve the South China Sea dispute, as well as how the political landscape has changed depending on who sits in the top seats. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Bill Hayton, Associate Fellow with the Asia-Pacific Programme at Chatham House and author of the book South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. Now, Bill, earlier we spoke about the political situation surrounding the South China Sea territorial and maritime disputes, as well as what your research has found towards the veracity of China's historic rights claim. But now I'd also like to talk about UNCLOS. The question has been raised over how effective UNCLOS is in the South China Sea, considering that China, when it ratified UNCLOS, placed a reservation that it wouldn't accept any kind of international arbitration on the South China Sea.
Yes, but by and large, the rules have held in places where the disputes, the territorial disputes, haven't been a factor. So, if these little islands, these rocks and reefs didn't exist, everything would be so much easier. It would be just like, for example, the North Sea in Europe, where although there are disputes between several of the states, they've basically reached a consensus on how they manage the resources. And yes, I guess, you know, when you look at the map and you see, you know, the maximum claim that China may be making now, and you compare that with what its lawful claim would be under UNCLOS, you see that China would lose a lot of its claim under an UNCLOS definition, which is presumably why they're sticking to their historic rights one, because they want to maximize the reach of their fishing fleet and their oil and gas industry. But the whole reason why UNCLOS was agreed was to try and stop disputes like this, and China, you know, signed up fully, took part in all the negotiations that determined the rules of the exclusive economic zone and all the rest of it. It was only after that it signed and ratified UNCLOS that it came up with these new historic rights arguments. And that's really where the trouble began.
You mentioned the Philippines, and that's also an interesting question, because the Philippines brought the case against China in the Permanent Court of Arbitration. But since Rodrigo Duterte has also come into power, there has been quite a notable shift towards China pulling away from the U.S. And that's been made concrete in the fact that the Philippines has pulled out of the Visiting Forces Agreement. So, you know, what's your take on this, and what will this mean for the South China Sea and the maritime and territorial disputes within that arena with Rodrigo Duterte in at the helm?
I think it's a difficult time, really, and it could be a time when the Philippines becomes more vulnerable. I mean, it might be worth sort of thinking back to 1994, shortly after the U.S. and so the Philippines cancelled a previous arrangement with the United States and was unprotected when Chinese forces occupied a reef called Mischief Reef, close to the coast of the Philippines, and the US basically, you know, stood aside and watched the Philippines lose that feature. I mean, Mr. Duterte is trusting in China's good offices, and yet there is reason to think that China is still keen on pursuing its territorial claim and may try and squeeze or push the Philippines off some of its features. He's putting a lot of trust in China's good offices at the moment, and he may or may not be rewarded. The problem is if he's wrong and he loses some of the Philippines' claims in the South China Sea, then he isn't going to get them back. So it's a tough one. And you know, for the Philippines' neighbors in Southeast Asia, I guess they've seen Philippines governments flip one way and then the other and then the other, depending on the results of elections. So, you know, you have, you know, before Mr. Duterte, you had Mr. Aquino, who was much more pro-US. You know, you go back to before that to Mrs. Arroyo. She was much more critical, much more friendly towards China. And you go back again, and the previous regime was much more pro-US. So, you know, trying to kind of, you know, see a consistent Philippine state policy here is very different and sorry, very difficult. Mm.
What about going through the avenue of ASEAN as a whole, right? Because so here in Malaysia, as you've said, Malaysia is one of the claimant states, and our politicians tend to veer towards the path of we need to negotiate South China Sea issues through ASEAN with China. But what's your gauge of that? You know, how successful might that be, considering that for China this is very much a face issue?
Well, I think China doesn't want to resolve the disputes with ASEAN collectively. It's prepared to negotiate a code of conduct about managing the disputes, sort of preventing them from getting out of control.
But that code of conduct has also been in process for over 10 years at this point.
Well, I would say almost more than 20. The first meetings took place in Manila in 1996. So by the time, you know, 2021 comes along, it will have been a quarter of a century. And the same issues just keep coming round and round and round. The fundamental problem with the Code of Conduct is that ASEAN states want to constrain China's behavior, and China sees no reason why it should allow its behavior to be constrained. So until somebody can come up with a reason to either persuade or force China to have its behavior constrained, it's just going to refuse to sign up to a Code of Conduct. So I don't see the Code of Conduct process going anywhere quickly, nor leading to any actual resolution of the disputes. China prefers, it says it wants to, talk bilaterally to each country concerning each of the claimant states, but won't say what it wants to talk about. I mean, if it's going to talk to Malaysia about resolving the bilateral disputes, does that mean it's prepared to compromise? It's prepared to say, OK, Malaysia, you can occupy those and we will recognize your claim? I don't think so. The same with Vietnam and Philippines. The impression I get is that what China wants to talk about in those bilateral talks is just how quickly the other countries, Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines, so forth, will give up their claims and hand them over to China. If China was to suggest that it was willing to compromise on the territorial issue, then there might be something for the other states to talk about.
Now, in your book, you mentioned that you believe the South China Sea could be the flashpoint for another war if the wrong circumstances were to play out. In effect, if someone were to hypothetically shoot an archduke. So, you know, what would be the trigger that you can see looking at the current political landscape?
Well, I mean, you have a lot of increasingly large numbers of warships, you know, transiting through the South China Sea, and increasingly assertive moves by the various sides. We had a near collision between a Chinese warship and an American warship called the USS Decatur. And from the video footage I've seen and other descriptions, I mean, it was clear that the Chinese ship, you know, set itself on a course that would have resulted in the American ship being rammed by the Chinese ship at one point if the American ship hadn't pulled away. And so, you know, what would happen in something like that? You know, if an American sailor got killed in something like that, where do we go from there? What would happen, for example, if a whole load of Chinese maritime militia fishing boat vessels manned by paramilitary crews, what if they blockaded an American warship and prevented it from leaving, and the American Navy, you know, went in to try and free this ship, and you know, again, there were casualties. So something like that could lead to a straight confrontation between, you know, two big navies, or it may be something that we can't predict. You know, like clash between fishing boats, which, you know, gets out of hand, and one thing leads to another. So I think this is the problem: is it's quite unpredictable to know what what might happen in any particular set of circumstances.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning to talk about this issue, Bill. It's been a pleasure having you.
Thanks very much indeed.
I've been speaking with Bill Hayton, Associate Fellow with the Asia Pacific Program at Chatham House and author of the book, South China Sea, The Struggle for Power in Asia. He also has another book coming out in September of this year titled The Invention of China. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.